Okay. I just dreamt up myself. Zhou-san is one of the ladies here. Okay. And she started talking to me in Cantonese. Very interesting.
Very good.
Another whole word. I only know one word in Cantonese, that's Zhou-san. That's it.
Zhou
was the one of my body. Bye-bye, okay. Okay, really good. So anyway, let's carry on with the sutras. And so now we're going to look at we're going to move on to the next sutra after the previous one. And this is called Atapana, on the next, first sutra on the next page. And so these are the different ways of thinking about the idea of right view. And this is one of these ways. And again, you will see here that SN, Samyutta Nikaya, the Collective Discourse Center, 48 is the Indriya Samyutta, yeah, the five Indriyas, which are the spiritual faculties. So these are the spiritual powers, if you like, the things that make the spiritual path kind of go work properly there. Yeah. And Sutta number 50. Yeah. So, anyway, so let's see what this sutta has to say. This is Venerable Sariputta speaking, and as I mentioned before, he was kind of the Buddha's right-hand disciple, and this is what he's talking to the Buddha here. So the Buddha asked him a question, this is what he replied to. You can expect that a faithful, energetic, mindful, noble disciple, with their mind immersed in samadhi, will understand this. Transmigration has no known beginning. No first point is found of sentient beings roaming and transmigrating, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. When that dark mass of ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, that state is peaceful and sublime. That is the stilling of all activities, the letting go of all attachments, the ending of craving, fading away, cessation and extinguishment. For the noble wisdom is the faculty of wisdom. So this is a very beautiful little passage, and if you are not used to reading the sutras, it may seem a little bit strange, perhaps a little bit cryptic. It may not be entirely obvious what is going on, so I will explain to you what is happening here. And what is happening here, first of all, we have the idea of the noble disciple. Yeah, this is the Arya Savaka, and these are usually the people who have had a full insight into the Buddha's teachings, the kind of insight you get after samadhi, as I mentioned before. So this is because they are noble disciples, they have these five faculties, the faculty of faith or confidence in the teachings of Buddha. You have confidence because you have seen them yourself, so you must have confidence. The energy which comes from that confidence, it comes from the knowledge that you have of the teaching. You are naturally energetic because you want to apply yourself to these teachings because you know what they are. From that energy comes the mindfulness, and from the mindfulness you develop the samadhi. If you have really good mindfulness, samadhi will tend to happen in your meditation practice, because you just apply the mindfulness to the meditation object, and when you do that, samadhi just happens. This is why mindfulness is so important in this practice. So if you have all of these things, then this can be expected. This is what you understand. This then is a different way of thinking about right view. Because that's what you get when you have deep meditation, you get right view. So this is this right view. The idea that transmigration has no beginning. No first point is found of sentient beings roaming and transmigrating, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. This is the insight you have. What is this insight? What is this right view that we're seeing here? It is exactly the same right view that we saw before. You may not recognize it, but you won't recognize it because it's a different way of looking at exactly the same point. Yeah, it's just alternative way of thinking about dukkha, about suffering. So here, the idea, transmigration has no beginning. It means that when you look back at samsaric existence, samsara just means the eternal going around from one life to the next one. Samsara is not the same as modern astronomy, the universe kind of expanding or whatever. Samsara is the inner world which always goes on from one life to the next one. There is no beginning. This is what you know when you have deep insight into these teachings. How can you know this? How is it possible to know these things? There's two ways of knowing this. And Buddha, for example, he knows these things from both these points of view. One is to remember your past lives. And when you remember your past lives, you go back and back and back. And you never come to a first point. Yeah, and you keep on going back. After a while, you're fed up going back. Okay, I'm going to be satisfied with this. I can't find the first point. Yeah, and you get fed up. But the Buddha is said to have recollected many eons into the past. And there came a point where he kind of, the time was going too fast. Okay, I better get out and start teaching, because otherwise I'm just going to be recollecting lives for the rest of my life. So you cannot recall so far. That's why it says it, that it has no known beginning. You cannot know the beginning. Because you cannot go back infinitely far, you can only go back so far. This is one way of knowing it, yeah? To know it by recalling your past lives. There's another way of knowing this. That is to understand, when you understand the Dhamma, when you understand the teachings of the Buddha, when you get insight into these things, one of the main aspects of that insight is the understanding of the relationship between craving and rebirth. Yeah, what you see that craving has the power to lead to rebirth at all times. This is one of the most important things you understand when you penetrate these teachings fully by wisdom. And because you realize that this craving is this force which is always looking to the future. Craving is always about the future. Yeah, when we crave something, it's because we're missing something now. We want something more. Desire is exactly the same thing. Desire is always about the future. So this is a force that propels you, drives you into the future. And as long as that force is there, you will also be reborn. You will carry on. Death is not going to stop that process. It will continue on into the future. So once you have seen that, you also know that it must also go back into the past. Yeah? Because if this life has come about as a result of craving, then that must be true also into the past, into the unknowable past as well. It becomes an inference, it becomes something you can deduce from the fact that, from what you see now, the connection between craving and rebirth. This is an insight. And this is a very important point. You don't actually have to recall your past lives. You can, all you have to do is just to contemplate these teachings very profoundly and contemplate your experience. And this is what happens when you contemplate it deep enough. You see this connection. This is a part of understanding. This is the essential thing when we talk about understanding dependent origination, which many people call the most profound teaching of the Buddha. And it is profound, but it's only profound because it takes deep meditation to understand it. But it's not intellectually difficult, anything like that. This is what you see. This is the essence of dependent origination. The idea that craving drives rebirth. Paticca Samuppada in the Pali language. And this is what you see. So what you see is this process carrying on and on and on. Seeing yourself going back. Seeing yourself having done the same thing before. Yeah, it is kind of in this life. You know, you think that, oh yeah, this life I've had enough suffering. Is anyone who hasn't had enough suffering in this life? Anyone who would like some more suffering? Nobody wants more suffering, yeah? Everybody wants less suffering in this life. That's one the reason why we're here. But then you see that it's not just this life. Imagine you have to repeat all the suffering in this life again and again and again. And in some lives you think it's much worse. This life, okay, it really hasn't been so bad. But in other lives, much, much worse again. And then you have done this a million times. Every time you think, yeah, I'm getting somewhere now. Yeah, this, I'm heading in the right direction. I'm getting somewhere. Then you die. You start from scratch. Yeah, you lost the wisdom that you had in your past life because you grew up in the wrong family or the wrong society, there was no Buddhism around or whatever, so everything was downhill. And it goes uphill again, downhill. You go kind of yo-yoing around samsara in this way, never really going anywhere, just yo-yoing around. And in your mind, you think, I'm going somewhere, yeah, I'm heading somewhere. No, you're not. Not going anywhere at all. Just going round and round and round, doing the same thing all the time. This is what you see. This is what the Buddha says you see when you have this kind of insight. And when you see this sort of thing, you feel the sense of enough. I don't want this anymore. This is terrible. This is dukkha. I want to get off this kind of wheel going round and round and round. This is what this is about. And you perhaps you think that this is crazy stuff. You think this is crazy stuff? No? Some of you are maybe used to Buddhist ideas and think it's okay. But sometimes people, when they first come to hear this thing, they think it's a really kind of strange way of looking at the world. But if the Buddha says so, and it's not just here, he says it in many, many places. If the Buddha, if the greatest spiritual genius in human history said this is how the world works, it is worth listening. It is worth taking it seriously. You don't have to say, oh yes, it must be like this. But at least take it seriously. At least reflect on this. Maybe life actually is like this. And that, you know, this just adds to all the problems I've been looking at before. Here, it is more based on faith and confidence because most people cannot actually see this. But still, it adds to kind of the picture, the Buddhist picture of the world. And it kind of, if you have an idea of rebirth, a lot of people have an idea of rebirth in the present day, not just Buddhist, Christian, many Christians believe in rebirth, many Muslims believe in rebirth, many atheists, agnostics, people who have no religion, free thinkers, whatever, they believe in rebirth. Rebirth is a very common view of the world. And I think one of the reasons why it's so common is because often we have a glimpse of these things, yeah? Sometimes we have a glimpse, and maybe recalling something from the past, some kind of memory which doesn't make any sense, or other people who we meet who say there is rebirth. I sometimes meet people who tell me to my face, there is rebirth. I think, oh, okay. It's like you blow your psyche over, yeah? Because these are people you trust, and people you really believe, and you can't deny it anymore sometimes. So because I think sometimes we are all tapping into what I would call an underlying reality. Yeah? Because we're tapping into that. It doesn't matter whether you're Buddhist or Christian or whatever you are. If you tap into that underlying reality, you will have some faith and confidence in the idea of rebirth. If you look at human society across vast expanses of human society, there was a book and study written by a Sri Lankan a man, he was an anthropologist, and he had studied the idea of rebirth around the world in very different societies. Societies in North America, societies in the Pacific Islands, in many different places that were completely isolated from each other, and they all had ideas of rebirth. It's a very common view in Buddhist, in human society, not just in Buddhist circles or Hindu circles, but actually across the board. The ancient Greeks, I don't know if you know, Pythagoras, one of the most famous of the ancient Greeks, he was believed in rebirth, yeah? Plato was supposed to have believed in rebirth. These things are very common. So anyway, it's worthwhile thinking about that, because sometimes, you know, people will challenge you on these things, and it's good to have a kind of a solid feeling for this. Anyway, so this transmigration has no non-beginning. Yeah, this is almost like the definition of dukkha. If you remember I said the other day, rebirth is dukkha, yeah, not rebirth is sukha, happiness. Well, this is kind of what this is about. So, no first point is found of sentient beings roaming and transmigrating. Roaming and traveling. I just love this sentence, and I kind of point it out every time I do a retreat, until people start yawning at the back because they've heard it so many times. But it's such a beautiful thing, beautiful in the sense that it gives such a powerful feeling for what this is about. When we use the word roam in English, roam means like without destination, without purpose. It's this random movement. If you are roaming around the streets of Hong Kong, it means you don't have a destination, just going here, going there, you know, looking at buildings or whatever you're doing, without actually a purpose. Yeah, and if you're roaming around in the forest, sometimes I go for a walk in the forest now and I'm on the street, and I don't know where I'm going. I think, okay, left or right, okay, eeny, meeny, miny, moe, okay, right. And that's actually left, right, and right. And then you roam around the forest. Sometimes it's kind of nice to be a bit random in life, not to have too much goals and destiny, but to live random life. Sometimes you learn new things when you live a bit, you know, a bit randomly, rather than always following, you know, strict procedures with everything. Yeah. But this is life. You're roaming around samsara, getting reborn here, getting reborn there, having no real destination, not going anywhere, up and down, across, sideways, along, sometimes being wise, sometimes being foolish, sometimes being happy, sometimes really suffering in life, sometimes being male, sometimes being female, sometimes you get reborn as an animal, sometimes you are like a god, and a god now. Wow. Cool to be a god, yeah? And then you're happy for a while because you live a godly existence for a while. And then you go down again. But no purpose, no goal, not going anywhere. Just this round and round. And after a while you think, why am I doing this? This is crazy. It's like you're roaming around the streets of Hong Kong. But you don't just do it for a short time because it's kind of nice just to see new things. But you do it all the time. Always roaming around the streets of Hong Kong. Imagine what that's like. Day and night, running around the streets. After a while it's pretty depressing. Yeah, it's pretty bad after a while. This is kind of the idea of samsaric existence. So sometimes it is only because we see this one life that it becomes bearable. If you see the whole thing, it becomes quite unpleasant. And then it says, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. And this is the problem. We are hindered by... Avijja Nivarana, I think is the Pali word for that one. Is it? I think it is. So hindered by delusion is maybe better. We don't really know what is going on. We're in darkness. Yeah, we are kind of in the eggshell. We can't see very far in this world. Because of that, because we are in the darkness, we don't know what's going on. We're hindered. We cannot see reality as it actually is. Because we can't see reality it actually is, we take this to be happiness, but actually there is a real problem here. So we are hindered by ignorance. It's such a useful thing to think about that. You know, when you look at the world and you think people are behaving badly and doing bad things, remember, everyone is hindered by ignorance. Don't really know what we're doing. We are blind, going around in darkness, hitting our heads, stubbing our toes because it's dark, you don't know what you're doing, and you are hurting yourself as a consequence. Hindered by ignorance, not seeing reality. This is why always seeing reality is a very positive thing. This is why right view is such an important thing, because it gives you that basic information upon which you then can start acting. Yeah? The idea of faith, confidence in the beginning, gradually making it your own understanding and your own wisdom. Hindered by ignorance, fettered by craving. Fetter means you are tied. Yeah, a fetter is something which ties you. So you are tied by craving. What are you tied to? You are tied to samsaric existence. You are tied to this ever running around, going around. So craving is the problem. Craving is what binds us. As I said before, craving is the source of rebirth. It's the condition that gives rise to rebirth again and again. This is the tie. And it's a very difficult time to overcome. And the reason this is so hard is because one of the main ties of craving, there's two main ties of craving. One is the sensual craving, yeah? The craving for the things of the world, the cravings for relationships, the craving for all the wonderful, beautiful things of the world. And because the world seems so, does seem beautiful sometimes, yeah? Oh, it would be nice to have a wonderful relationship, and then travel around a little bit and enjoy all the pleasures in the world. Because it seems, on the surface, it may seem very pleasurable. It is hard to understand the limitations of that world. But with a little bit of reflection, a little bit of common sense, we can see the limitations of that world very quickly. That is why I was emphasizing all of these ideas before, remembering the unreliability of the external world. How incredibly hard it is to, how it cannot be controlled, and that's why it is so problematic in the long run. But it is a very difficult thing to let go of, and that's why we are fettered by this, tied by this, attachment to all the things in the world, all the things we own, everything that really is meaningful to us. And even more deep is the craving to exist. We want to exist. Yeah, we want to be here. And this is even more profound. But the most difficult tie to overcome is just the tie that we have to the sensual world. And you will notice that when you become peaceful in the meditation practice, there is less or less of those attachments there. There is less desire. And already you start to understand why desire and craving is a problem. Yeah, it stops you from becoming peaceful. It stops you from seeing clearly all of these kind of things. So this is this idea of dukkha. Yeah, we are tied by craving to the world. We are blinded by our delusion and ignorance. And because of that, we keep on going around and around, roaming around, not going anywhere. And one day, we come to the Buddhist path, the Buddhist practice. Doesn't even have to be Buddhist practice, any practice which leads you in roughly the right direction. And you start to untangle this problem. Untangle, you're moving out of darkness, gradually moving into light. Gradually light turns out. You see more and more the fetter, the binding to the samsara becomes weaker and weaker. Until one day you escape the fetter altogether and you no longer bind to this existence. Oh, what joy to know that there is no happiness in the world. Yeah, that kind of beautiful paradoxical thing that you see at that particular point. So, that's why it says here, when this dark mass of ignorance fades away and ceases with nothing left over, that state is peaceful and sublime. The real happiness, the real peace comes when you understand the world for what it actually is. Craving goes. When craving is gone, you become peaceful. Craving and desire are the main thing that stops us from being peaceful. That always drives us on and on and on, doing things and giving rise to the will and all the doing in the world. So it fades away. Nothing is left over. That state is peaceful and sublime. Yeah, sublime is, whoa, marvelous. I like the way the Buddha has always been understated. You understand it? It's peaceful and sublime. It doesn't sound like much. Until you realize this is the highest happiness you can possibly attain as a human being. Yeah. So this is how the Buddha understates things a little bit. So when the Buddha says it's peaceful and sublime, he means it is really, really peaceful and really, really sublime. There's no kind of partial results there. Yeah. That is the stilling of all activities. This is the stilling of the will, the stilling of running around for all these meaningless things in the world. The letting go of all attachments, the sub-upadi, pati-nisagata. Upadi is like attachment and ownership. The ending of craving, the fading away of all this craving, the cessation of craving, extinguishment, nibbana, the liberation from the defilements and the craving. This is the highest happiness. For the noble wisdom is the faculty of wisdom. That's what you've seen. You want to see this? Maybe. It's interesting, isn't it? This is what is so interesting about this path. But sometimes this path seems kind of scary. Is this really what you see? I mean, it's maybe better to be deluded, not having to see all this. Yeah, because it sounds almost too much. But don't get this wrong. The point of this is not that this isn't really scary. The point is it's liberating. When you see this, you are freed from an oppression. That is the whole point. So the reverse, the opposite side of the coin here, is the degree of happiness. And this is what you start to see in your meditation straight away. This is why meditation is happy. Because you are actually starting to let go of these things. Craving actually is going down. Desire is going down. You feel more peaceful. So if meditation is happy, you're already on the way to nibbana. You already have a taste of nibbana. Okay, tiny taste. Yeah, because nibbana is so much more. But every time you become peaceful, there's a tiny taste of nibbana. Why? Because nibbana means extinguishment. Extinguishment of craving. Extinguishment of defilements. If they are extinguished a little bit, it means you have a little bit of taste what it's about. So don't be afraid. Instead, ask yourself what this path feels like. And if it feels a little bit good now, it's going to feel much, much, much better down the track. And you know that just by extrapolating, like looking at this into the future, so to speak. It may sound kind of scary, but actually the whole point of it is to encourage you on the path. It's an idea of right view. That is your wisdom that you have when you see this. And then, when the Vasari Buddha says, when a noble disciple tries again and again, in other words, you put forth energy again and again, when you use mindfulness, just recollect again and again, this mindfulness again and again, when you enter samadhi, immersion again and again, and you understand with wisdom again and again, you will be confident, you will have faith of this. I have previously heard of these things, yeah, just like now you hear about these things, but now I have direct meditative experience of them. I see them with penetrating wisdom. For the faith is the faculty of faith. Yeah, so you move, starting out with confidence. But in Buddhism, confidence and faith is never an end in its own, on its own. It is always a cause or something to start out with and turn it into wisdom. This is one of those interesting things about Buddhist practice. In Buddhism, there isn't much difference between confidence and faith and wisdom. These things are very closely related to each other. If you have confidence in the right thing, it means you already have a degree of wisdom, because you know where to have confidence. You are thinking about the world in the right way. Buddhism is not about blind faith. Buddhism is about reasoned faith. Faith that is intelligent and reflective, not silly faith. And in this sense, whenever you have faith for the right thing, you already have a bit of wisdom. You base yourself on that faith and build up more wisdom. When you have more wisdom, that means your confidence is stronger, so you actually have more faith. So faith and wisdom go together in Buddhism. It is very different from most other religions, where faith is something on its own, which stands on its own. In Buddhism, it always goes together. This is very reassuring, yeah, because you know what you're talking about. You don't have to blindly believe in something that you can never know, which to me is utterly scary and utterly crazy. It's one of the reasons I could never have much faith in Christianity, because I thought there's something very wrong with this idea of just having kind of faith in something that you don't know anything about. This is why to be a Buddhist made much more sense. Yeah, here, wisdom and faith grows together. This is the right way. This is how a reasonable person should think about the world. And I was lucky, my family wasn't very religious, but it couldn't really, so for me it was very easy to abandon religion. But to some people, they're very kind of immersed in kind of ideas of God or whatever, very difficult to abandon sometimes. This is, to me, a much more sensible way of approaching the world. And this is one of those beautiful things about reading the word of the Buddha. It is so sensible, yeah? It just makes sense all the way. It's kind of, yeah, I can really believe in this. It is, this is something I can follow. Because the Buddha is talking to people who actually are reflecting properly. And this is kind of one of the wonderful things about these Buddhist teachings. But Buddhism itself also, remember, Buddhism also has a lot of strange things in it. And a lot of those strange things, they developed after the Buddha passed away. And this is one of the reasons it's so nice to come back to the earliest teachings of the Buddha, because those are the teachings that are the most simple, the most straightforward, the most logical, if you like. Yeah, they kind of make sense. They go, and also at the same time, they are emotional at the same time, and they have an impact on you in so many ways. If you go to later Buddhism, very often it becomes a bit like Christianity. Yeah, you believe in the Buddha, oh, please Buddha help me, and it becomes full of magic and all kinds of things. And I don't know about you, but to me, it's not very attractive. I get put off by that kind of religion. It becomes too much based on empty faith very often, and not really based on proper practice and proper living the life in a good way, in a positive way. Anyway, we can talk more about that later on, but now we should focus on the idea of right view here. So faith and confidence, or confidence and wisdom, faith and wisdom are very closely related to each other in Buddhist teaching. Right view, wisdom, faith, confidence, all of these things have a lot in common. So let us move on to the next one. So these are all really hard-hitting suttas. These are the suttas that kind of, you sort of feel, oh, this is a... I didn't know this was in the suttas, and actually many of you have been Buddhists for a long time, so you may know about these things already, but they are worth reflecting over because they are there. The next one is called Kirtan. Yeah, it's not a very good starting point. It doesn't sound very optimistic. This doesn't sound like it's going to be very positive, but let's see what it has to say. This is from a collection of suttas called the Annamagga Samyutta, Sangita Nikaya, the 15th collection, the third sutta at Samatida. Mendicants, transmigration has no known beginning. No first point is found of sentient beings roaming and transmigrating, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. So this idea is a very kind of common idea in the suttas, so there you have it again, just the same idea as we had before. Sentient beings, not just human beings, all sentient beings have this problem. What do you think? Which is more, the flow of tears that you have shed while roaming and transmigrating it for such a very long time, weeping and wailing from being united with the unloved and separated from the loved, or the water in the four oceans? It's a lot of water in the four oceans. Yeah, this is like the ancient Indian idea of the oceans of the world, and now we have maybe a probably better idea, but still a lot of water. So they're saying here that the amount of water you have shed just from crying is more. Yeah, probably, as we can sort of assume what's coming next, is more than the water in the four great oceans. As we understand the Buddha's teachings, the flow of tears we've shed while roaming and transmigrating is more than the water in the four oceans. Good, mendicants, it is good that you understand my teaching like this. The flow of tears you have shed while roaming and transmigrating is indeed more than the water in the four oceans. For a long time you've undergone the death of a mother. Yeah, you have experienced the death of a mother, the death of a father, the death of a brother, the death of a sister, the death of a son, the death of a daughter, the death of relatives, the loss of wealth, the loss through illness. From being united with an unloved, separated from the loved, the flow of tears you have shed while roaming and transmigrating it is indeed more than the water in the four oceans. Why is that? Because transmigration has no beginning. No first point is found of sentient beings roaming and transmigrating, hindered by ignorance and fettered by craving. This is quite enough for you to become disillusioned, dispassionate and free regarding all conditions, sabbe sankhara, all phenomena in the world. So when you look at life in this way, you become disillusioned, or you get almost like aversion. You don't want to have anything to do with this existence anymore, because it is endless moving along. You're always coming back to problems, always people dying in your family, and usually it is very painful if people die in your family, unless you have developed your practice a long way. It doesn't have to be if you are wiser, but for most people it is very painful. And this is why this sort of problem arises. And then you get disillusioned, you get an aversion to the world, you reject it. The deeper this insight is, the more you reject that world, you throw it out, then you become dispassionate. You lose your desire and craving for the world. This is how you then make that breakthrough we were talking about before. And then you become freed from all conditioned phenomena. All conditioned phenomena, what is that? Everything. Yeah, everything around you is a conditioned phenomenon, so you get freed from all matter. Freed means you have no craving for it anymore. You have no attachment to it. That's what freed means. When you have no attachment to it, it means it has no power over you. And you don't stop grieving and crying. And the flow of tears finally comes to an end. Dukkha. I told you this is going to be about the first noble truth. Yeah? This is why this is the first noble truth, because obviously it's about dukkha, suffering. The next one, this doesn't look very promising either. In a sorry state, type of an next sutta. There's one depressing sutta after the other. If you get really depressed, please walk out. Yeah? Don't be afraid. You are allowed to walk out any time. Okay. In a story state, at one time the Buddha was staying near Saravati. Mendicants, transmigration has no known beginning. No first point is found of sentient beings roaming and transmigrating, hindered by delusion and fettered by craving. When you see someone in a sorry state, in distress, if you look around the world today, if you look at people on TV in all the various countries, actually, you should probably, even though there's troubles in Hong Kong, still, Hong Kong is pretty good by world standards. Yeah? A lot of suffering in this world, wars and misery, people getting killed every day because of all kinds of terrible things. So the Buddha said, if you see people in a sorry state, in distress, people who are poor, people who are starving, people who are depressed, people who are committing suicide for all kinds of silly reasons, people who have illnesses, all of these things, you see these things all the time. When you see this, what should you do? You should conclude, in all this long time, I too, it says we here, but you can say I too, have undergone that same thing. Why is that? Because again, transmigration has no beginning yet. No first point is found of sentient beings roaming and transmigrating yet, hindered by ignorance, fettered by craving yet. This is enough for you to become disillusioned, dispassionate, and free regarding all conditioned phenomena. This is kind of nice, This is also very beautiful in some ways. You're looking at the world and you see other people or animals or whatever they are, and you remember that you too have been there at some time. And in the future, quite likely, you may go there again, unless you practice really well on the Buddhist path, or any path which leads in a different direction. And that takes away the sense of alienation. Sometimes you look at TV and it's like this in a foreign country, far away, got nothing to do with you. It has something to do with you. Yeah, you have been there as well. You will very likely go there again. And when you think like that, you bring it closer. You understand more. You feel more the pain and the problem in the world. You understand that there is a real problem there. I too have experienced these things. And it opens up your heart to other people. Sometimes it's easy to be, not to feel these things properly because they are far away or whatever. But it's important to open our hearts to the suffering of the world. Not too much, not so much that you become completely paralyzed, but enough to understand the limitations of the world. And that sometimes, being willing to share and to help people, even if they are strangers far away. One of the things about the Buddhist path is the idea of generosity. Generosity is very important in Buddhism. And if we are Buddhists, very often we tend to give to Buddhist causes. And of course, it's a wonderful thing to give to Buddhist causes, and I'm not suggesting you shouldn't do that. But our heart should really be open to everyone. So what was that then? The heart should be open to everyone. And the idea is that when your heart is open to everyone this way, you don't just give to a Buddhist cause, but you give whatever you feel, compassion, whatever you feel is in need. This is really the right way to have generous, to be generous. This is the idea of a kind of a be generous wherever there is a requirement and a need. It's actually good to think of this, because often we tend to create barriers between people. Sometimes we need to reduce those barriers. When we do that, we become more fully human, and we include everyone in our kind of circle of who we consider as kind of brothers and sisters in this world. Maybe I will stop there because it's already 11 o'clock here, and it's lunchtime. Yeah, it's always a good time to stop when it's lunch just coming around the corner. I know that Gerald is very, very kindly going to produce some lunch for me, so my craving is overcoming. So I'm going to stop that easy. Anyway, so keep on enjoying yourself. Have a nice lunch. And we'll see you back again at 3 p.m. this afternoon.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.